Well, welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California right here in Oakland at Fluid 510. I'm Michelle Miao. I'll be your moderator this evening. And I have a program here at the Commonwealth Club and also am a member of the Board of Governors. Generally, I'll open up by saying that the motto of the Michelle Miao Show is we're your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. Tonight, we have a special program for you. It's our second program ever. And thanks to Fluid 510, we're able to be here in Oakland. It's very special for us. I was telling a couple of you, well, yes, of course we're in Oakland. It was so weird to invite Oakland members to San Francisco to talk about Oakland issues. Tonight, we're going to talk about ceasefire. And so for many of us, ceasefire might be a new concept, but for those who have lived in Oakland or born and raised, you know what ceasefire is. But it might be a little bit of a refresher course, but it's also going to be a point of conversation of how we move forward and talk about public safety tonight. So let me introduce to you our panel, our esteemed panel. We have Pastor Dixon from Thy Word World Ministries and also board co-chair of Faith in Action East Bay. We also have with us Captain Frederick Shavies, who is acting captain of the ceasefire program for OPD. And last but not least, we have Dr. Holly Joshi, who's the chief of violence prevention for the city of Oakland. Let's welcome our speakers. So ceasefire, yes, this started, I guess it was a national program. Maybe Boston started it, but it definitely wasn't a new concept to Oakland. It launched in 2012. I think we'll just give a refresher to everybody here who's here tonight and for those who are listening. And if you're hearing it for the first time, just some historical context. So we'll start with Pastor Dixon. I think you're a good person to start with this and kind of give us, yeah, what exactly is ceasefire or ceasefire Oakland?
Well, ceasefire is a proven strategy program that changes the course of shootings in any major city that it was conducted. It was a book called Don't Shoot. And we got our start from there reading that book. And before I came to Faith in Action East Bay, it was called Oakland Community Organizing. And the members of Oakland Community Organizing decided that they didn't want people just to stop shooting, but we wanted people to stay out of jail. We wanted neighborhoods to improve. We wanted communities to reach out and know that we're concerned, we care, and that we love them. So in 2008, they actually started pushing OPD. If you notice, I just say OPD came to us. The community took ceasefire to OPD and said, this is what we want to do. This is something that's a proven strategy. It was called the Boston Miracle. If you read about that, you can go back and read about the Boston Miracle, how they didn't have anyone die under at the age of 18 and under. They had nothing going on. Their kids lived, and it changed the whole shooting and everything in Boston for 2 years. So OCO decided that they would go do research, and then they brought in the chiefs of Oakland at that time. And they start pushing for it. Fast forward up, they had a big meeting and had a whole bunch of people out there saying, we won't cease fire. And when you produce 2,000, 3,000 people, it's somehow the city gets the point that you want cease fire. So I like to go back to where I started. I was picked up. I was a new pastor. I just took over for my father at Thy Word Christian Center, at Thy Word Ministries at the time. I took over from him, and I had worked, being transparent, I had worked in the jail for 28 and a half years as a correctional officer. I did programs and all these things. And a young man told me, asked me to escort him back, real quick story, because I think stories prove the point. And he said, Dixon, can you take me back? Well, he said, preacher, can you take me back? Because I used to preach in the tunnels. And my boss says, as long as we don't get no complaint, you can preach all you want. And so I took him back. And he says, you know, if somebody like you was in my life before all this happened, I probably wouldn't be in this position. He said, make me a promise. I said, okay, what's the promise? That you'll continue speaking to young men like me so they don't wind up like me. He ended up getting 25 years to life, and he was only 22 years old. So that comes push back for it. I started working in 2010. I became the pastor, took over from my father. My father's still here. He just had enough sense to understand that it needed new blood and new vision. And so we come in, and this Chief Howard Johnson, if I'm correct, Jordan, Howard Jordan, I always mess up his name. He calls me into a meeting, and it was the larger churches in Oakland there. And I looked around because I have a little small church. And I said, Chief, why did you call me in here? He said, because you know how to speak to them. And so that was my start of being a community person through that chief. And then we went on to some chiefs. 2012, we decided that ceasefire was going to be the way. The chiefs of Oakland at that time said, we're going to do ceasefire. We did a community walk. We brought in Reverend Brown from back in Massachusetts. We all met at Allen Temple, all the preachers in the city, and it was a remarkable turnout. It was thousands of people there. We had all the pastors, and I was this little old pastor sitting in a corner with the smallest church. And at that time, J. Alfred Smith Jr. was there, and there was a long relationship with our families. And he said, whatever Dixon is doing, that's what we're doing. And because of that statement, a lot of pastors took place in ceasefire. And then we had David Muhammad, who came in, and he started the first what we call custom notifications, going out talking to young men involved in violence, offering them programs and change. And we went out, five pastors and one probation chief went out, and we started that. And then it just picked up from there. We had great people like Captain Chavis here, Assistant Chief Jones, retired Captain Joyner, if I'm correct, Chief Armstrong, who was a big proponent from sergeant to he became chief. And just a FYI, me and Armstrong, we grew up on the same block as kids. So that's something good can't come out of West Oakland. We grew up as kids in West Oakland. His brother, my brother, went to school when his brother was shot in the hallways. So this gun violence thing isn't new. So we picked up that and we moved forward from there. And of course, you know the story. We started ceasefire. There was a lot of wrecks in between, being transparent. There's a lot of wrecks. We were mad at OPD. OPD was mad at us, but somewhere we figured it out. We came together with all the mistakes that was made on both sides, all the mistakes that were made. The community never lost its focus, even when OPD was going through a trying situation. We never lost our focus. We kept walking. We kept telling people we cared for them. We kept feeding people. We kept doing all the things that needed to be done. And so with that happening, ceasefire comes in, Libby and new chiefs came in, and we dropped the murder rate from being in triple digits to 67 in 2018. And that was a big, big drop. And we owe it all. They can point it all to ceasefire. But what was remarkable, what a lot of people don't understand, that not only did the murders drop, but the shootings stopped. The robberies dropped. All these other things happened also. So we know that ceasefire was a proven program. And we thank all the chiefs, all the captains, all these great officers that made an effort. And what another part people don't know about ceasefire is the police accountability part that nobody sees, because it's guys like Captain Chavis and myself behind closed doors yelling at each other, saying, no, that's not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to do it this way. And they're like, but you don't understand. And you're right. We don't understand. There's big arguments, and people might not see that part, but that's another part of ceasefire, police legitimacy, procedural justice.
Thank you so much, Pastor Dixon. Chief Joshi, did you have something to add?
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, it's so clear how long Pastor Dixon has been involved in it, and he was instrumental. And I was there when all of that was happening, and those are all true stories. I think what I'd like to add is just to try to break ceasefire down to its simplest components, because it is fairly complex. but I try to make it as simple as possible. So it's focused, it's a focused deterrence model. And as Pastor illustrated, it first was born in Boston during the late 90s when Boston was having a rash of shootings, particularly involving gangs and groups and juveniles in their urban environments and under-resourced communities. And then it moved to Chicago. We actually took the Chicago model and made it our own. But what focused deterrence says is that if you focus city, community, and police resources on the 350 to 400 people in our city, that's the number because it's always just a little bit less than 1% of your general population. If you focus your resources on those 350 to 400 people that are at the center of violence and that are most at risk for either being shot or shooting someone else within the next 90 days or so, we're talking about imminent violence. It's not a an upstream program that gets way, you know, stops things before kids get, it's not a gang, it's not a traditional gang intervention program in that it's stopping kids before they get involved in gangs. Like, we have those and need those as well. But Ceasefire specifically is dealing with the individuals that are currently involved in gang and group violence and driving shootings and homicides in the city. And so it's data driven, and it uses data analysis and intelligence coming from the street to identify the gangs and groups and the individuals that are at their center of violence. That's step one. Step two is a direct communication with those individuals. And that's what Pastor was speaking about. The direct communication either happens at a community call-in. We had our last one last month at Lakeshore Baptist Church, and it involves a whole host of community members, pastors, faith-based communities, the police department, the district attorney's office, federal prosecutors, us at the Department of Violence Prevention, community-based organizations, etc. We bring in a small people and we communicate a very specific message, which is that the violence has to stop. Your life is in danger and you're also on law enforcement's radar and at significant threat for going to prison for a really long time. But there is a way off and there's an off ramp. And so the Department of Violence Prevention, which I run, offers the off ramp. We're always working off two different lists, and we call them deconflicted information because OPD is producing two lists. One list I call List A, that is the people that are driving violence in this city at any given time, but are arrestable. They have evidence. There's video. There's a witness. The police have evidence. Those folks are going to get enforcement action for violence. We don't see that list. That's why I call it deconflicted information. That list belongs to OPD. List B are the people that have been identified as being at the center of violence and at risk who are not currently arrestable because we know how difficult it can be to build a case. Sometimes it takes a long time. That is the list that I get. And I call it the golden list because that's the list that we get to intervene in and we get to offer the off ramps. And sometimes the off ramps look like relocating people to different states because they cannot get out of violence without having a temporary timeout outside of the city of Oakland. Sometimes it looks like getting them in job programs, therapy, on and on and on. But I'll talk more about, you know, kind of those pieces. But I wanted to just make sure we all have a good understanding of like, what are the main components of Ceasefire? The goals of the program are very specific. Reduce homicides and shootings community-wide. And for the individuals that are being identified, it's to reduce recidivism so that they're not going back into the criminal justice system. And we are disrupting the prison pipeline and prevent them from being victimized or victimizing someone else. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Anything to add, Captain Shavies?
They both did an eloquent job of explaining what Ceasefire is. I think one of the ways that we're able to get there, and I think that at the time Dr. Joshi was working within the police department, there was a huge trust deficit on both sides. And so me as being a young supervisor of the first Ceasefire enforcement team at the time, my lack of trust for community and then obviously community's lack of trust for the police department for so many reasons that I don't need to necessarily explain to you all here, but just understanding the Oakland Police Department and its role and its history within our community. And so how many folks that were out in our community that just didn't trust us, right? And we didn't necessarily give them a reason to trust us. And so being able to work with Faith in Action, work with the various CBOs and NGOs prior to DVP being codified and institutionalized within the city of Oakland, we were able to build some extremely strong relationships. And a lot of that came through, like you said, knock down, drag out conversations, but then also working hand in glove with one another on the streets, involved in direct communications, right? So oftentimes people look at the police as just the enforcement arm of ceasefire. And I think it's far more. While there is an enforcement aspect to it, one of the things where we've seen where we've had our biggest successes are in our direct communications, where we're out in the community with members of our community, with people that are family members and loved ones of those that are most affected by violence, begging and pleading with them to put the guns down, but then also offering an alternative, whether that be through services, job training, or even stipends or per diems, as a relocation, whatever the case may be. And so I think working over time, we had built such a great relationship that somehow a lot of people's relationships were strained during the pandemic because we didn't have that opportunity to come together as community, to get out in community, and to be with one another. And so I'm extremely grateful for where we are now. I couldn't be happier to have Dr. Joshi as a partner in Pastor Dixon. And so I'm excited to talk about it. And I'm passionate about reducing violent crime in our city. I've grown up here. I've been in the city of Oakland since 1980. Never lived anywhere else. I still live here in the city. And I think it's important. I'm raising children here in the city. It's important that not only do we reduce violent crime, but that we offer a pathway for all members of our community to thrive.
So, people who actually live here, we know what's happening in Oakland. But at the same time, right, there's this conversation that's happening where people ask the question of who exactly is at risk of engaging in the crime. Because I think that it gets conflated with, well, the people who live in Oakland are the people who are committing the crime. Maybe, maybe not. But that's the question back to you as a panel. Who actually is at risk? Who are we talking about?
So ceasefire at its core is a data-driven strategy. And so one of the things that we wanted to do when we implemented ceasefire is to understand who it was that was involved in violent crime. And like Dr. Joshi said, it's usually less than 1%. And so in the past, when we saw crimes occurring within certain communities, we would take a scorched earth approach where we would saturate those areas with police enforcement. And oftentimes, those that were involved in violence or in any sort of group or gang criminality would understand that the police were out and they'd lay low. And those who were affected were the mothers just trying to get their children to school, the people trying to come home from work or go to church, and then they're stopped. The person who is just trying to make ends meet, maybe not have current registration or even a driver's license, they'd end up having their cars towed, and that's their only means to work or their means to worship or their means to provide for their family. So what we wanted to do was lighten our footprint or reduce our footprint within our community. And so it was more of I know retired Captain Joyner he likes to say when we were talking about ceasefire, in prior days, we would take a machete to crime. And with this, we were trying to use a scalp to go in and not completely damage the limb, but just take out what was ailing it. And so that's one of the things that we did, obviously reducing our footprint. But to your question, who and what is driving violence in our community? We see that it's a small group. We do believe that there are a number of individuals that are from our community. But we have seen in recent years, especially looking at, we had huge displacement and gentrification throughout the 2010s. And so a lot of members from our community have been displaced, but I still consider those community members because they were here and they were displaced for whatever reason. And so we have folks that are in our communities that are engaged in crime. And I think one of the things that we're trying to understand is, are these crimes of desperation when it comes to some of the property crimes? And with that, we could try to provide resource or help in any ways that we can as a city. But when people are harming other individuals, there has to be some sort of intervention. And that doesn't always mean arrest. And oftentimes it looks like interrupting or preventing. And that's where DVP comes in, but they're not alone in that. They also have the police department as an ally to intervene in that crime. However, when we ask that you put your guns down and you choose not to, and you choose to continue to engage in violence, and you choose to turn down the resources that are being offered, we believe that accountability matters, both internally and externally. And so while we need to be held accountable, we also feel that we need to hold folks in our community that are doing harm to our community accountable as well.
Can I just jump in on this? As being a community member and a community outreach, we want everyone to stay free. We want everyone to not be incarcerated. We want everyone to live the best life possible. But at the same time, as a community member, we tell OPD to enforce after we've talked to them. Now, you may think we just talked to them once. There are several notifications. There's several what we call customs where we knock on that person's door. There's several notifications of those people in that community. There's a whole lot of things telling them to put down the gun, stop shooting. So it's just not like, okay, you shot and it's over. We come to get you. It's not nothing like that. It's actually saying, hey, here's your chance. And ceasefire at its best was gave people an out. I'm hot. The police is looking at me. Y'all know I'm hot. So I'm going to go sit on the corner and take these services and take this job and take this whatever over here before. Now, there's just some that's not going to put down the guns. There's some that's not going to stop shooting. And as a slang term, they need to go sit down somewhere. And that's what we tell OPD, to go make sure somebody sit down so that we can bring peace to our community. And we really want you to understand that, because I'm not going to just let OPD run roughshod through our neighborhood. We're just not going to allow that. At least Faith in Action, East Bay, and community members are not going to do that. But that's why we start. and I trust him. And like I said, this has been since 2012, building this trust, building trust in what they do and what they say. And so it's hard, but this is the work that needs to be done. So we don't want you to think that they're just kicking in doors at will. Usually, the people doors that they're kicking in have been the ones that have been driving the violence.
Yeah, thank you both. I think it's really what will be illustrative of this, the change in OPD tactics, is me telling a quick story about how OPD operated when I walked in the door in 2001 versus once ceasefire took over in 2012. So in 2001, the way OPD would do homicides and gang investigations is they would still create the two lists that I described earlier. So they would still create list A of the people that were arrestable that we were to go out and serve warrants on and take into custody. They would create list B, who are the people that are at the center of violence but are not currently arrestable, right? And most oftentimes you would walk into a lineup room and all of those folks' pictures would be everywhere. And it would be in every officer's mind that we need to build cases against these people at some point. The issue becomes at some point. You know, it can take a long time to build cases against people. And what would happen sometimes is that I would walk back into the lineup room and there would be an X on that person's face because they'd already been killed. The other thing that was often happening was that while we were trying to build a case, they were still committing violence and there was no intervention happening. It was only information that the police department held. So when ceasefire came along and the pastors demanded list B, that's when list B began being turned over to the service providers. So that's why I call it the golden list, is because it's the list that for the first 10 years of my career, OPD lingered on the walls. And now is turned over to service providers, and we have the opportunity to provide that off-ramp and to do that intervention. So I just wanted to, you know, echo what they're saying, that yes, ceasefire absolutely reduced OPD's footprint in the community by giving them data and having them focus specifically on the people driving violence. And it also took a lot of the folks off of the walls and put them in direct contact with community service providers.
Can I just jump in here? He's being real modest. They drove down violence while making less stop of Black and brown people. I don't know if that deserved a hand clap. They drove down violence while making 10,000 less stops of Black and brown men. That is something great when you start thinking about pinpoint targeting information. That means I wasn't pulled over in my car and asked, was this my car? True story. In Oakland. You know, that means that I drove down the street and I wasn't part of their target. And so I can take my car and keep driving down the street. As long as I wasn't drag racing and doing, I didn't get pulled over. So that's what I'm talking about. They did a great job. And sometimes we do need to tell when OPD does do a great job. And we thank you for that part.
Yeah. Talking about those off-ramp opportunities. And this is, you know, it's not meant to be a loaded question, but do we have enough resources to provide those opportunities? Do we need more?
Can I answer that? We always need more money. Can I just be real? We always need, if you gave me $50 million right now, we could probably spend it this fiscal year with no problem. We always need money, but what do we do? I can tell you a story where Assistant Chief Jones and I went out and a guy said, you want me to do ceasefire? And all you're going to give me is $600 a month. And I got three kids, a wife and a family. That's some real talk. I didn't have a comeback for that. I had to sit down and think. But now with ceasefire, the way it's made now, we have opportunity to do great things. We have opportunity to meet some people where they are. We have opportunity to try to find housing with the new housing grants and stuff like that. And we need more housing. So if you know anybody that would like to send us $450 million for housing, please contact Chief Yoshi and she'll handle that and make it happen. We need housing. We need all these things. We're always going to need that. Let me share today. We went out, and I usually don't talk about it because I'm real quiet about what we do. We went out. The custom notification team went out. And then today I went out and I talked to a group of men and I said, I want to do a barbecue just for you guys where I can bring the service providers to do the talking and do that while the community church members serve the people. That means the life coaches wouldn't be doing all the work. That costs money. We thank God for the grant that's coming to us for doing the work, that we can put that on. And we know that we directly affect a place that's been shot at three times within the last 2 weeks, to have conversations with people to stop the shooting. Do we need more money? Do we have enough resources? No.
No. I want to second that. And I've been on a fundraising campaign for the last 90 days. I've been the new chief for the last 90 days. So day one has been a fundraising campaign, asking legislators in Sacramento to invest in the strategy, asking the feds to invest in the strategy, private funders to invest in the strategy. But as Pastor said, definitely housing and livable wage jobs are the things that we're always trying to identify for our people. But also just in terms of like additional violence interrupters, additional life coaches, we need like staffing levels to be raised inside the city in order to meet the full demands of the strategy. And then of course the supports directly for clients. Can I just say one thing and be fully transparent with you all? Because I'm sure you're thinking, if this strategy works so well and it was called the Boston Miracle and then it came to Oakland in 2012 and you all had these amazing results, what happened? Because I'm not seeing it, not feeling it. So 2012 to 2019, we'll call the ceasefire years, and crime went down. Ceasefire, as a pastor said, was given credit for reducing shootings and homicides by 50%. And that low year that we had, which was like 68 homicides, I think, or was it 64? 68 homicides. That still sounds like an egregious amount of homicides and killings. I don't want to downplay the number, but it's not 134, right? Which is what we'd had previous to that and where we're headed now. So what happened is that the pandemic is one thing that happened. The other thing that happened is that I think we might have gotten a bit distracted because we were having such good luck that, you know, how sometimes things are working so well for 7 years, you kind of start to get too comfortable. So we stopped investing as much in the strategy. It's just, we did. This administration and the mayor commissioned an evaluation of ceasefire, and that report can be found online. It's public. And it was done by the California Partnerships for Safe Communities. They are national experts in focused deterrence strategies, and they outlined with 50 pages everything that wasn't happening that basically said we had no fidelity to the model, both on the police side and on the Department of Violence Prevention social services side. We were just off track, period. And we could spend the next 20 minutes with me detailing exactly how we're off track, but just know that we have committed all of our time and resources this past 90 days to getting us back on track, which has resulted in reorgs in both departments and retraining and just getting us back focused. And we're already seeing the fruits of that labor. And so we're not bragging yet, but we're already tentatively hopeful because we are seeing violent crime numbers begin to decline. And ceasefire is a strategy that, when implemented with fidelity to the model, it works fairly quickly. So we're not talking about something that should show violence reduction in years from now. We're talking about months. So I'm feeling good about it, but wanted to be really transparent with you all that, you know, the strategy just wasn't strategying. And so now we're back on track.
If you read that report, you'll find out that there had to be some major changes in these last 90 days. Once again, they're not giving their self credit because I'm not downtown fussing, screaming, yelling, kicking, saying, where are the people? Where are the manpower? What changes are you making, chief? Just in the 90 days, I've seen life coaches be placed in a place where they can be more effective. I've seen OPD just recently. We're training two new officers that are going to be dedicated to the ceasefire model that they're going to be going out. The teams went from two teams to look like it's going to be four or five teams that are absolutely going to be doing the work. So they don't give themselves enough credit. Trust me, if they're not doing the work, I'll be right on them if they're not doing the work. But there are changes that I see that I like because they're not changes to throw people in jail. They're changes to change people's lives.
Dr. Pastor and Captain Shavies, do you have anything to add with regards to the conversation around the funding, the financials? I mean, from a community point of view, do you need money to do what you do with regards to ceasefire?
I'll answer for the chief. Yes, they need money. Let me tell you why. A city our size, if you go to Cincinnati, which doesn't have the type of gun violence and violence that we have, they have 1,000 officers. We have 730. You go to other cities our size, they're well in number and officers. I'm not saying that I want just any officers. I want special officers. I want them hand-picked officers. Matter of fact, I'll put my interview now. I want to be handpicked and picking those officers that come in on the reel. They're doing a great job with what they have, but we need the funding. They're not going to say nothing. They're going to say we're going to do the work that's before us, but they do need officers. But guess what? Violence and prevention need more money because we're having more people that need services more than ever. And our services are reaching out further than you think. We've been out to Antioch. We've been out to Pittsburgh. We've been out to Manteca. We've been out to Modesto chasing guys that have done shootings or were victim of violence in Oakland that may have imprints, footprints in Oakland to try to prevent a retaliation shooting. So there's a whole lot of work that needs to be done. That means we have to take a person from the violence prevention, our OPD with us, all the way out there, our probation office, all the way out there to talk to this guy, to let them know and to find the services out there in their community that we can connect them to. And there's a whole lot of work. And if you start thinking about that, that's a lot of money, a lot of manpower that needs to get this done. But one shooting, I think it was $3 million, they said. One shooting cost us $3 million.
I think the city and the state as a whole are facing budgetary constraints. And I will say that we, as Ceasefire within the Oakland Police Department, often are always looking for grants that can help us. But also think what's important is that we deploy in a meaningful way. And so I guess that's my answer to your question.
That says it all. Thank you so much. We got a great stack of questions, so I'll go ahead and ask some from the audience here. This is a good question. Why would a person on the golden list agree to come to an event? How do you reach them and encourage them to participate?
So I was going to give it to you, but I guess that question actually is for the Oakland Police Department. So we often come up with this list, and we communicate with Pastor Dixon, probation, and others to ask for them to come. Sometimes we make it a condition of their probation, but the goal is just get them in a room and help them understand what it is that we're trying to do. It's not a roundup to put trackers on your car or to follow you when you leave. The goal is truly to get them in a room, express to them that we want to see them thrive and be thrive within our community, but then we leave. So I don't know that we talked much about the call-in. So the way that the call-in works, this golden list, the call-in works where we get a group of individuals from our community and their family members, if they like. The room is comprised of those that we believe are most at risk, being victims or suspects of violent crime, members from the Oakland Police Department, the District Attorney's Office, the Probation Department, a number of clergy from throughout the city, oftentimes families, mothers, fathers, brothers, or sisters of individuals that have been killed in our community, DVP, United States Attorney, FBI, DA, ATF, anyone that you could think of from the enforcement side, and then folks from the community side. And once we talk and express to them that this is a gotcha, that we care about you, we are asking you to put the guns down. We then leave. And we turn it over to DVP and the services and allow them to, for lack of a better term, let their hair down and understand what services are being offered. And we pray, or I don't pray, but some people pray, that they take them up on those services. And that, you know, I mean, that's the goal. I'll pray with you later. So
Captain has hit it pretty much. What happens is in that room, you have all the community people, and then you have what we call speakers. Those are affected by violence. You have the OPD. You have myself, who leads the meeting, along with the chief of OPD. We lead the meeting, and we have the conversation. We tell them that we're not here to scare you. We're not here to try to intimidate you. All we want to see you is alive, free, and doing well. We care about you. We care about our communities. We care about what you come from. And we have requests that you put down the violence. But if you don't put down the violence, we demand that OPD do their job.
Yeah.
That's the first thing they hear. And it comes from the pastor. And if you see how I'm dressed, I went out to what we call a custom notifications or reach out. And this is how I dress. So they know where it's coming from, so that we take responsibility along with OPD. So if OPD do bad, then I do bad. So I'm not going to let OPD do bad, because I'm not going to do bad, right? So that's the whole thing. And what he's so modest.
No,
they have things before they even get to the meeting.
Yeah.
They go out and talk. They go out and talk to guys and say, hey, we want you to come to this meeting. Here's a flyer. Here's your notification. Can you please come?
Yeah.
We need you to be there.
All of it is like, so you said, how do you convince people? It can't just be anyone. I think it takes a credible messenger to have a conversation with an individual and ask that they come out. I wouldn't send, no disrespect to anybody driving down the street in vehicle 1439, let's say, or whatever. I'm not necessarily comfortable asking Joe Blow patrol man or woman to give that message. But I think that as an agency, we're working toward, and a lot of it starts with procedural justice and folks that the police legitimacy, folks that need to go through the City of Oakland's Advancing Racial Equity Academies, and we need individuals that know how to communicate and work with our community. But I think it's a credible messenger and someone that is respected both internally and externally. And that's genuine more than anything. Because I think a lot of folks, no matter what they're involved in, can usually read BS. And so it needs to be a credible messenger, someone who's genuine.
Yes, I totally agree on the credible messengers. And on the Department of Violence Prevention side of the equation, the vast majority of my staff are people with lived experience of violence or incarceration themselves. And so they are literally a walking example of the other side of this. And so when we're putting a team together, which is usually a pastor, a faith-based leader, a law enforcement person, so either OPD officer or probation officer, and then a violence interrupter from my team who is previously involved in the life themselves, that's the trifecta. And so the call-in the big room is one way that we're doing these outreaches, but sometimes we only do those quarterly. So we can't wait around quarterly. So we're really actually doing the custom notification and the messages several times a week out in the community and for people that are in custody as well. Because sometimes the folks that we've identified being at the center of violence are in custody and they're not going to be in custody for very long, or they're in custody and they're shot calling from jail. Right? Like they're still influencing violence. And so we're doing those and sending that trifecta of I'm going to call it a golden team now. So now we have the golden list and the golden team, and they're going out to communicate the same message that we communicate in the large community setting, but more frequently and with more people.
There's a question from the audience about long-term sustainability of the program. And then another question, I'm just going to marry another question. And the other question about other agencies and constituents, have they come on board to support the ceasefire program? And I don't know, you know, I'm not sure if that is part of the answer for sustaining the program. But what are your thoughts? And it's open to anybody here on the panel about how we sustain the program and if we need other constituents to join in to support ceasefire.
Yeah, I'll start from my lens. I think that this evaluation report that just came out, you know, a month or two ago, is really going to be foundational to us sustaining the program, because it outlines what worked when ceasefire was working, what happened and what went wrong and how we got off track, and how you build a sustainable program and what it takes. And one of the things it takes is like a commitment from city leadership, from the mayor's office and the city administrator's office, of course, with support from council, because the strategy isn't actually run out of OPD or the DVP. I mean, we do like a lot of the heavy lifting, but in terms of holding us accountable to our goals and having the coordination meetings and then having the monthly performance evaluation meetings, like all of that is run by the mayor's office. And so I think from my perspective, yes, it's about ongoing funding and all of that, but like it really is about ongoing commitment from city leaders.
And I also, I'm extremely interested in actually submit a memo or proposal or to think about to our executive team about taking ceasefire regionally, understanding that crime shows up in different communities differently. We also know that a lot of those that are involved in violent crime in our city traverse the region, the county, the surrounding counties, right? And so, but also understanding that, I guess in my opinion, if we did take it regionally, with that comes a lot of additional training around cultural competency and procedural justice. And I'm hoping that that actually shifts the culture and policing overall, right? And so that we go from less of a warrior mentality, right? However, I'm only in charge of those that I'm in charge of. And so trying to shift police culture is going to be a heavy lift, but I think it's important. And I think this is a start, right, towards approaching enforcement in a different way.
Let me take you back to take you forward when we first started Ceasefire, OPD invested in its community, and we all went to Chicago. And we sat in Chicago PD and see what they were doing. And some words I can't use were said in there. And I was like, wow, okay, we're going to get somewhere here because people are being transparent. And even the people in Chicago was like, whoa, their community, that was a first for them because they never had community involved in making a police decision. So when you say, how is this sustainable? It's because of y'all, not because of them. Because when we all get together and say we won't change, and we know that this is a data-driven program and that it works, I asked Chicago, what happened to your program? And they said, we stopped doing the program and murder shot up. I asked them, what happened in Boston? Everybody got big-headed, included in community, and they stopped doing the program and violence shot up. What happened in Oakland? We stopped doing the program and violence shot up. So it's up to us to understand the program, understand that it's data driven, understand that if I can stop the murders, then I'm gonna stop the bipping. Or y'all try laughing at that, huh? If I stop the murders, I stop the bipping. I stop the murders, I stop the robberies. I stop the murders. Oh, see, there's a connection to all this. Because now, if I don't have to worry about 130 murders, I can put those extra cops while still keep doing the program. And guess what? It's a data-driven program. So if we get the murders down, guess what? We can use the same data on bippers. These are the guys that are doing bipping. We know this is doing bipping. We have an idea. We can call them into a ceasefire and tell them, you better stop bipping or he's going to go to, you know. But we want you, and here's some programs, here's some schooling, here's some education to help you, and because it's a data-driven program. But lives are more valuable than property.
Thank you.
I don't know if you want to jump in, but additionally, what we saw the first time around with Ceasefire is that the folks that are driving gang and gun violence in the city are not just doing gang and gun violence, right? So they're trafficking, sex trafficking, they're robbing, they're committing home invasion robberies, et cetera, et cetera. So in addition to pastors' connections, I think that as we get back into the program and our intelligence grows, we'll probably start to see that again, or maybe you're already seeing it again.
I think that that's true. And I think one of the things that we found and one of the things that we focused on was group and gang violence against one another. Right. But what we also understand is that there are individuals that are group and gang involved that may or may not necessarily be they may be perpetuating violence, but they're also driving up and down Broadway and each side street, breaking into cars. They're doing commercial burglaries. We had an officer that was killed in late December by a group that traditionally was involved in gang violence against other gangs, but had decided it's more profitable for us to engage in dispensary burglaries or robberies, if you will, armed burglaries, and willing to be violent with anyone who may try to stop them. And so we've seen that these same individuals that we believe are involved in group and gang violence, which we know from certain scientists that we've used to process evidence, are also involved in burglaries where shots are fired, robberies where shots were fired. And so understanding that same list, that same 1%, the list doesn't grow exponentially just because you get away from gang and group shootings or network shootings. It's the same individuals. That same list are those that are engaged in a number of offenses throughout our city. And so it's not like, oh, there's 1% involved in violence, but 37% of Oakland are bippers. That's just not true. And so,
Dr. Joshi, I know you've only been on the job for 90 days, but pressure's on. So, you know, how much of an impact have we made? And if you can share some data, I think there were some questions here. People would like to know, where are we at now? And if we're just getting started, you know, what's kind of the plan forward? And the question really isn't just for you, but anyone could jump in after you.
Yeah, I'll leave the crime stats to Fred, but what I can say is our first call-in, like I said, we did, I think it was February 22nd, and we called in 11 individuals, and 9 out of those 11 individuals have already signed up for our services at the Department of Violence Prevention. So, you know, we would love all 11 of them to have already been, but typically and historically, the uptake for services around 70 or 80%. So we're on track in that regard. And just receiving referral after referral for all of the custom notifications that are happening several times a week in the field. We got 7 referrals the other day. I'm like, this is amazing. And I'm going to run out of space on our case management soon. So again, back to, you know, me fundraising and trying to get more staffing, but it's looking extremely promising in terms of the social services side and the clients being willing to participate with us.
So we have a goal as an agency to reduce shootings, homicides, and robberies by 10% each, right? We are on track in shootings and homicides. We have work to do on the robberies. I'm looking around the room. I don't see any former police. I have a former corrections and former police officer here. But in the police world, when it's a really quiet night, you get upset when somebody says, man, it's quiet out here tonight. Because that means... And so while I don't want to jinx myself, we are on track to exceed our goals. We need to continue to work hard and continue to message and continue to stay on it. We don't want to rest on our laurels. We think it's important. We also know that we're going to get a little bit of rain this weekend, but we know that as the climate warms, traditionally we've seen violence. And so last year in June and July, we saw 16 homicides each, so 32 out of the, that's nearly a third, or just between a quarter and a third of our homicides total happened in 2 months last summer. And so understanding that has traditionally been the months that we saw violence, we'd like to create a delta between our homicides year to date from last year to now, and then again get ahead of any would-be violence that we see brewing. And so And when that looks like custom notifications, that looks like engaging with folks in call-ins, that looks like working with DVP to get interrupters out immediately when there are shootings. Folks within those that have been harmed or that have committed harm, their sphere of influence in order to try to get individuals to put the guns down. So we're working in the right direction. We want to keep that momentum.
I believe the same thing that they just said. We just have to continue pushing what we push, as I'm always going to say, being out in the community, being part of the community being part of the night walks, letting them see you. Even at my church on 89th and International Boulevard, they leave from there sometime. We used to leave every quarter, but I had to share because everybody said, you get them all. So I had to spread out. It's amazing when the community that sees people that don't look like them, when they see people that don't look like them shouting, we love you, we care about you, we're out here walking in this neighborhood that we're not from because we care about you and we want to see you alive. All those parts have to play a part of the statistics. And once again, the mayor's office plays a great part in driving the statistics, because without her telling the Department of Violence Prevention, you will do this, and without her telling the police department, you will do this, and even holding the community accountable about what have you done to help us to see, keep this violence down. So the mayor office, and we had our first one for this year just a few weeks ago, and it was outstanding because she took notes and then told everybody what we were going to do. And you need that from a leader. So we thank the mayor's office for that leadership also, because it takes all this for this process to work and to get those statistics down. I would like to, they said 10%, but don't ask the community, because the community are talking 20 to 30%, but that's just the community.
We got time for a couple more questions before we say goodbye, but I'm pretty sure you all feel the same like I do. We could be here all night long, right? Sharing conversations and discussions of how we can be engaged and how we can love our community back. There's a good question about this, because I was playing this in my mind, you know, the call-in and where it would be. Like, I'm thinking, I think it's at a church. But the question is, you know, where is it? Where's a good place to hold the meetings? Like a neutral place? I don't know. You could tell us exactly where it is. But
I won't tell you exactly because it's a sacred. It's sacred. And yeah. You just put it like that. It's very sacred. We don't want everybody showing up. We did this in 2012 or 11, we went to City Hall and everybody from the city showed up. Everybody. I mean, we had people all. And how many of those guys felt like they were in a fishbowl and felt like you're just using me for a show. So we pick a location after listening to those that participated in it before. We can't go over there. We might get shot at. We can't go over there because we might get shot at. So you have to listen to the what they're saying also. So we found a neutral location where everybody can go and everybody got to make a run for it. Then the OPD is fully protective of everyone there. They have everybody there. I like to mess with them, get them upset, but they have everybody there. It's ready to go. We go to that location. They know they're there. We greet them as soon as they walk up. There's OPD, there's probation, there's community people, there's the violence department for prevention. And of course, they call me the pastor because I bring all the food and make sure all the food is there and so that they can eat. And all that stuff is there to encourage them that we're for real and we're really concerned about you. We love you. We want you to be safe and free.
Pastor Dixon touched on it. I think one of the other things that we don't bring rival groups or gangs there to instigate any sort of conflict. We don't tell a lot of folks where it is because we don't want other people coming and looking at someone who may be what the streets would call an op. We want this to be a safe space for individuals to come and feel as though they're safe and be able to have an open heart and open mind to hear what services are being provided for them.
And that's why you don't see a lot of guys like me doing this. They won't do something like this because we don't know who's following them. We were doing custom notifications. And while we were doing custom notifications, while we were doing it, we were on Instagram and Facebook. And they say, look at the OPD. They got a guy dressed up as the pastor.
And we also don't. We don't take videos of the call in. We're not recording it. We're not live streaming. We're not putting it on social media. Just for those reasons, we want individuals to feel safe in that space.
But let me finish that part. Before we left out, somebody seen that and said, take the pastor and the person from DVP off the video right now. That's just the pastor. You need to listen to them. They're offering you service. And that video came off right then and there because credible messengers. We're credible. They know that we're not there to harm or hurt. Our footprint is not there to kick in your door. We're there to help you. So that's why we say, you know, we won't never tell you. We won't never. If you're invited, you're invited. And it's hard to get an invite because it goes through a whole bunch of people. And you got people like me saying, no, that person can't come. Why are they coming?
The last question I will ask, it is from the audience, and I think it's a great question, but also maybe it's a positive one that we can end with. Are there opportunities for folks who have benefited from ceasefire programs and services to become service providers or have input in ceasefire services? I think a good way to ask this also is, you know, kind of share with us a positive story or whatnot once somebody does accept the off-ramp opportunities. Just so we remember, right, the impact of ceasefire.
I mean, there's just so many positive stories. I mean, the first thing is that all the ceasefire clients who successfully went through the program are alive. You know, I mean, that's a win because that wasn't necessarily their guaranteed destiny. But I mean, we have ceasefire guys all over the city, all over the state doing positive things, union jobs, all kind of things. I mean, and like I said, the service providers that are working at the Department of Violence Prevention, almost all of them have lived experience and they've either been incarcerated or involved in gang and group violence, mainly in this city. It's some of them, when I was out as a brand new OPD officer in 2001, we were on the opposite sides of this conversation. And now we work together on the same team. You know what I mean? And the Department of Violence Prevention's service delivery model and commitment to hiring people with lived experience is really the first time any city department has made that commitment. You know, we had to basically come up with new policies and procedures for onboarding people because the city had never hired so many people with lived experience in the past. And so I think just generally speaking, as a group of ceasefire program graduates, there's just so many positive stories. I mean, one of the guys who got called into the last call on February 22nd was in the midst of all of the group in gang violence. And I mean, that was, you know, 3 weeks ago, and he's already showing up for his life coach meetings every single time, coming into the office several times a week, and was just connected with an organization called CEO that does job development and job training. And he starts his job training on Monday.
The recidivism rate of those that participate in ceasefire that came to the call-ins is at 80 to 90% doesn't go back and do those things. So do we have some people that didn't take the advice and they unfortunately had to have police action? Yes. But when we see the guys come back to me and say, hey, I done ceasefire. When you see guys that open up their own private gyms and all these things, and you start seeing all these type of guys doing great work, and these guys reflecting back on, man, you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. We just heard a story just the other day of a guy got on Facebook and he said, man, you need to pay attention to ceasefire up there shooting guns with your grandmother. And he was going off on the internet. I'm like, show it to me. And they showed it to me. I was like, wow. So you know that the word is getting out. And that guy was shot at. And what was amazing is that he didn't go back and shoot back. That's when you know that the message is getting out. And a lot of the things that we won't never see are the people that are not participating, the people that we talk to that are not shooting people.
We haven't hired anyone, any of our clients at the police department yet, but the strategy is still young, though.
Let's give a big warm thanks to our speakers tonight, Dr. Holly Joshi, Captain Frederick Shavies, and Pastor Dixon. Thank you to all of you for joining us here at Fluid 510 for our second ever Oakland Forum for the Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California. I'm Michelle Miao, and you can catch any of our programs at commonwealthclub.org or any of my programs at commonwealthclub.org/MMS. Special thanks to Sean Sullivan and Richie, who are right behind there, and Matt, Magic Matt, Fluid 510, for hosting us. We'll see you next time.